time for Yakety Science. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the laboratory, the test tube, and the cyclotron. The show that finds the cackle in your cosmology, the mirth in your mycology, the jolly in your geology, the knee slapper in your nematology, the ha-ha in your hydrology. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College, and your humble host. Joining me today are the other members of this week's Yakety Science team. First up, the Wallace to my Darwin. Wait, that elevates you to the status of biologist.
Unless
right?
you're going with like Wallace and Gromit. That's where
Wallace
I thought you were
Wallace and Gromit, okay.
The Wallace to my Gromit.
The Gromit to my Wallace. Dr. Matt Smith, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
I'm happy to be here.
And our guest host today is Claude Bowles, former professor of geology at TCC. He retired in 2018 after 35 years at the college. Because he just can't stop teaching, he gives geology lectures to civics groups and the Tulsa Rock and Mineral Club. And he also gives geology tours of downtown Tulsa, looking at the materials that the buildings are made of. Is that correct, Claude?
Yes, this is Claude Bowles, the geologist. And why did I retire? My calculator was older than most of my students.
Oh, there you go. So I think it's great to have Claude here because he brings together biology and chemistry.
Does he bring them together?
He does, because biology fossilizes. And so much of what geology does is they're looking at different strata, different rocks based upon the fossils
that
are there.
So when biology dies, but then geology comes alive.
Ah, that's a good one. Yes, that's a good one. Yes,
I'm just glad that we got someone who is neither a biologist nor a chemist. So now that means, Claude, you have to choose.
The listeners love conflict. That's why people watch The Real Housewives of New Jersey, and that's why they listen to us, right? Same
that's
reason.
That's what we are, Real Housewives of the Lab.
Exactly the same motivation there, the same attraction.
Okay, I have to choose between biology and chemistry. Geology is an eclectic science which combines biology, astronomy, chemistry, and physics. And so I'm kind of split between the two. But if I had to lean to one side or the other, and my two colleagues were over here giving me both a thumbs up, it has to be chemistry. I'm a little more inclined
to
chemistry.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Claude. As I understand you have to rush along.
He's here to stay.
All right. Okay, I forgive you, Claude.
Thank you.
Yeah, so.
Thank you. And although I must admit that I do very partial to biology because my favorite aspect of geology is collecting fossils, which is biology preserved.
All right. We're going to learn more from Claude later in the show, but for now, how about some headlines?
Let's do some headlines.
Up first, we have Assassin's Creed Bacteria. This is an article published by Stubisch et al. In the June 12th issue of Science magazine. This is the research into a particular mechanism that some bacteria have for injecting their competitors with a toxin via a little needle. So they have this sort of needle that extends out and pierces their competitors, pierces their neighbor, injects toxins.
So this is like some sort of like single cell Ezio Auditore. That's the protagonist from Assassin's Creed 2, by the way.
Ezio Auditore.
He's looking at me blank wise.
I don't play Assassin's Creed. The things that came to my mind were the spy services, the CIA, James Bond, His Majesty's Secret Service. We even have a name here. It's the T6SS.
Sure.
It sounds like some new system developed by Q and James Bond. But this is the system that allows them to create this needle and to inject these toxins. And this is in addition to all the other ways they have of killing each other. There's lots of violence going on here at the microbial level where they're kind of releasing toxins into the environment. This is just a little more precise. You're just sort of reaching out, touching a neighbor and injecting poison. This system was already known. The T6SS was already known. What they really clearly demonstrated here was that not only do they kill their neighbors, but also they seem to subsist off of the nutrients that are released, right? The carbohydrates and things that are released from the cells that they kill. They're killing off their neighbors and then they're absorbing it. And they even...
I guess I don't really think about bacteria waging war and fighting each other.
It's, I mean, this is where we get all of our antibiotics from, is from the microbial warfare that's going on.
So. Right?
So fungi killing bacteria and bacteria killing each other. And so, I mean, this is the original battlefield.
So humans literally are no better. We do the same things.
Wasn't it Lucretia Borgia that had a ring that had like a little bit of poison? And I don't know if there was a needle associated with it, but there was a poison. For some reason, I thought there was like a little needle that she would use, but maybe it was just she just would pour it into someone's drink. That probably makes more sense. You're more likely to notice when the noblewoman comes up and
sticks
a ring into your side than when she discreetly poisons your beverage. All right.
Well, it'd be awkward, like, to actually, like, would it take two hands? Can you get it open with just a finger and, like, flick it in there or something? Or
I don't know. Maybe it had a little button on it or something. It popped the top off.
This can't be that high tech.
Why not? It's the Renaissance. This is the time of Leonardo da Vinci and all of his fabulous inventions and things. Right?
I guess. So.
The Renaissance. It's the start of the Little Ice Age. Whenever it became colder from the 1500s into the early 1800s. And so very cold, people stayed indoors and invented devices to...
To murder people, I think. They spent all their time plotting murder. This is the Medicis and the Borgias. And
I was trying to be optimistic to the human race.
I mean, the Renaissance has it all. It has plenty of reason to be optimistic and plenty of reason... for pessimism as well. Up next, we have a wandering North Pole. This has to do with true polar north, which is the geographical North Pole, and that position on the physical mass of the Earth. So where is that located? That point could be anywhere. If you kind of rotated the Earth around, then, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma could be at the North Pole, or Nairobi, Kenya could be at the North Pole. So any of those things could be at the North Pole, being, you know, the spin axis, the point around which the Earth is rotating. The title of this article is True Polar Wander Driven by Artificial Water Impoundment, 1835 to 2011. So as you can tell from that title, what they're focused on here is big, giant reservoirs. So you got these big impoundments. That is a big mass that is sitting somewhere it wasn't before. What they think they found is a correlation between that change in the distribution of weight and the change of the position of true north. And they noticed that this was, they said, non-monotonic, which is a fancy way of saying that it moved in one direction and then moved in another direction. So they are attributing all the impoundment of water in North America as we industrialized. That kind of trapped some mass up on top of the North American continent.
Was it parked where it wasn't supposed to be? They had to impound it?
It was, right? And so they had it impounded there. That caused movement in one direction for polar north. And then more impoundment started to happen in Asia in particular, I think, in Africa. Mm-hmm. And so we had polar north move back in the opposite direction.
We need to have a physicist here to describe the impact of angular momentum.
Well, in the absence of a physicist, we'll go with a chemist instead. It's the best we've got. Sorry.
Yes.
Well, yeah, what I'm imagining is that you're spinning in a chair. If you pull your arms in, you start spinning faster. And then we put your arms out again, you slow down again. And then you can, it seems like it's a bit like that. When we have our mass distributed further out along our equator, more of our mass further out on the equator, we're impounding all this water up above. That is slowing down our rate of change.
So there are two things going on here. So if you have more kind of mass at the equator and kind of bulging out farther from the axis, then yes, you're going to slow down. What's happening with this water impoundment is that you have an uneven distribution of the mass, and that is causing the mass of the Earth to tilt relative to its axis. So imagine that you are... not just sort of expanding your arms out symmetrically, but you're expanding them all out on one side. That's going to cause your mass to shift relative to the spin, right, if you do that. And so the idea is that all of the mass is kind of sort of trapped out on North American continent with this water impoundment, And that caused shift in one way. And then we have all this mass that was trapped out over Asia and in Africa, and that caused a shift in the other direction. So it's a kind of an asymmetric thing. So there's a shift in the position, right, relative to the axis. But you're right. The Earth is slowing down. The change in kind of distribution of mass from the poles towards the equator that happens with the melting of ice, right? All of that's putting water into the oceans, which then is changing the distribution of the mass. And that has resulted in a measurable decrease in the rate of spin of the Earth.
I can think of one other possibility. Have you ever seen a globe mounted in a stand? You have wing nuts at the North Pole and South Pole. Uh-huh. I contend that people have been turning those wing nuts too tight, which is making the Earth bulge at the equator, which is upsetting the rotation.
Now he's on to it. That's the conspiracy.
That's a bold hypothesis. The thing that really hits me about stuff like this is we should not have...
We shouldn't have this much control. Or not out of control, but this much of an effect.
It's just an amazing fact that something that human beings are doing, changing the climate and melting the ice caps, but also impounding water, changing the position of the Earth and changing the rate of spin of the Earth, that is just a mind-blowing fact. Up next, we need to take care of last episode's Sound Science Puzzler. Here it is again, in case you don't remember it. All right, that's it. That's last episode's Sound Science Puzzler. What are we listening to there? Matt, do you have any guesses?
Well, I remember that they say their name. They say, cicada, cicada.
Listen more carefully. I too have trouble understanding what they're saying, but I'm pretty sure it's not cicada, because cicadas are calling in the daytime. These guys call at night, kitty-did, kitty-did, kitty-did sound. And that is what you're hearing, is the sound of a male katydid calling. They do what's called stridulation, and that is essentially rubbing two wings together. They have one wing that has kind of a sharp edge to it and another wing that has little ridges on it, and they just kind of rub that back and forth, and that, you know, makes the katydid sound. So that is what we're listening to. That is one of the sounds of Oklahoma summer. That is what is either delighting you or vexing you, depending on your disposition and your mood when you sit out on your porch at night in a wooded area. Those are the katydids up in the trees. All right, up later in the show, we'll have a brand new Sound Science Puzzler for you.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's...
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 years. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt takes up another key element, atomic number 7 on the periodic table. That is nitrogen.
That's right. It's nitrogen. And nitrogen is the one element that you have encountered more than any other element in your life.
Is that because we're swimming through it?
Because you are. You're swimming through a sea of nitrogen. That's right. Nitrogen is 78% of the atmosphere. So it is most of the molecules that you are breathing in are those little N2 molecules, diatomic nitrogen. That's what it is.
And you're colliding with them all the time.
All the time. In fact, you know, the fun little factoid, the nitrogen in the atmosphere, given the temperature that we're at right now and given the molar mass of nitrogen, nitrogen molecules move at an average speed of about 1,150 miles per hour.
Wow.
That's what's going right now.
Colliding,
you are getting hit in the face all over by 1,150 miles per hour, and you don't even notice it.
It's soothing.
It's soothing. Yes. I mean, it honestly kind of is, because you would notice if it was different.
You would notice if it were not there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If the barometric pressure changes, you're like, those nitrogen atoms aren't hitting as hard as they used to.
The alternative is the vacuum of space. And
yeah, that would be less fun at all. Absolutely. So the etymology of nitrogen comes from the word for nitre, which is saltpeter, sodium nitrate. And one of the, let's see here, Brian, you're probably your favorite nitrogen-containing compound would be.
Ammonia?
It is ammonia, yeah, which is also named for an Egyptian god. Amun is named for it because it would burn nitrogen-containing compounds in their services. So.
The smell of ammonia was pleasing to Amun.
Apparently, he just likes that pea smell.
It's an interesting...
So nitrogen is obviously extremely important to the biological sector, isn't it?
It is true. It's part of protein. It's part of DNA.
It is. And it's most of nitrogen, the nitrogen industry here on Earth, about like 3/4 of it just goes to making ammonia, which is fertilizer.
Right, exactly.
You use it in fertilizer. Yeah.
And do you know who came up with this process of producing ammonia fertilizer?
I'm betting you're going to tell me.
It is Haber. Fritz Haber is the main person who is responsible for this. The Haber-Bosch process is a process for essentially, you know, using a lot of heat and a lot of pressure in order to kind of break that bond. All of the molecular nitrogen up in the atmosphere, as you can tell us, Matt.
It is hard to break that apart. It's triple bonded.
We've got to do that. We burn a lot of fossil fuels. We create a lot of heat and pressure. And then we, break that bond and we make the fertilizer. Fritz Haber, interestingly, also the father of chemical warfare and considered by many to be a war criminal.
A war criminal.
It's a fun fact.
Goodness.
Yes.
Goodness. Wow. Way to sing his praises, then.
He's a complicated guy.
Well, right? Sometimes you can't choose how your science is used, but I think he actually did. Didn't he, lead that?
Oh, yes. No, he commanded the units that first deployed chemical weapons on the front. This is back in World War I, so it's back at the beginning of the 20th century, where you have trench warfare, and this is just sort of a war of attrition, and they're trying to develop all these new ways of murdering each other with more and more efficiency, and...
Absolutely awful.
Father of chemical weapons.
Well, you sing the praises of ammonia and what a great industry it is. And yet, nitrogen is one of those things where, yes, all biological functions, plants, animals, we need nitrogen. But too much nitrogen can cause environmental problems, can't it?
Are you referring to eutrophication?
I think so.
I think so. Part of what's happened with that ability to fertilize our field so thoroughly is that we put too much fertilizer on there. That fertilizer gets washed off into waterways. That leads to blooms of algae in streams and in oceans, the Gulf of Mexico and so on, are affected by nitrogen fertilizers. Also, phosphorus is a big part of that as well, too. But that leads to these blooms of algae that then has all sorts of negative ecological consequences.
Especially when the algae bloom says, oh, I'm here, and then it dies off. And then all that decomposition sucks all the oxygen out of the water, and you end up with deoxygenated, anaerobic.
Yeah. So some of the algal blooms produce toxins as well, too. So.
Yeah, great. So some nitrogen, good in moderation.
Good in
That's my tagline for nitrogen today.
Everything in moderation, Matt.
That's right. Claude, what do you feel about nitrogen?
From a geology point of view, I'm not that excited about it because it doesn't make up many of the minerals that I'm comfortable with. Although, whenever you mention about it's in the air that we breathe, I'd put it a little bit higher. So I know you give a rating. I give it a 2.
A 2, he says. You know, I'm kind of feeling that you got to have enough nitrogen, but not too much. Means I can't rate it too high or too low. It's vital, but you can overdo it. So I have to give it a 3.
I was going to go for 3, but... It's, I agreed with you last week. We were in accord last week on carbon. I don't think we can have...
We can't sustain that.
We can't sustain that. There's no way to sustain that. So I'm going to give it, just to make the math hard, I'm going to give it 3.5 stars.
3.5 stars. Very well. So let's see here. Let's do the math. That is 3.5 plus 3 plus 2. That is 8.5 divided by 3.
That's right. So if I do that math real quick in my head, I think that's 2.833, right? So that
you biologists are so quick.
I know.
Looking forward, I see that the next element on the periodical table is oxygen.
Yeah.
And oxygen is the most abundant element in the Earth's crust, and number 2 is silicon, and those two elements bond together rather nicely to produce most of the minerals that we find in the Earth's crust.
That's true. We should have brought him next week.
Yes, that's why. Way back when, I leaned more towards chemistry than biology.
Yeah, but then you leaned back. You remember you leaned back.
Yeah, leaned back because of paleontology.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So. He leaned back. He might fall out of his chair. He leans back.
He's a teeter-totter over here. He's going back and forth.
Wishy-washy.
Yes. This is another edition of the segment we have come to call Disappearing Science. We like to keep it light here at Yakety Science Laboratories. But the prognosis for American science is not great, and we want to be in touch with reality. The thing that caught my attention was the plan to cut the LIGO program. And the LIGO program stands for the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. And so they have two long tubes that go at right angles to each other, and they shoot light, and they bounce the light back through the tube. And then they create an interference pattern, right, where the two light beams cross. And then what that detects is gravitational waves. What's a gravitational wave, Matt?
Gravitational wave is kind of a ripple in space-time that you get when very, very massive objects in space collide or get very near each other, such as black holes, such as orbiting neutron stars, such as, here at Yakety Science Laboratories, Brian's ego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they can create these ripples that go throughout space.
Well, wait. What's the other massive object? It's got to be your it's got to be your bow tie.
Yeah, you're right.
Bow tie and my ego.
It's just both of our egos, honestly. That's how it goes. It's both of our egos.
Right.
Create these ripples that you can't really feel.
We're talking about ripples that amount to less than the diameter of a proton. So we've got really, really small effects here that need to be detected.
That's why the things have to be like kilometers long.
Yeah,
right?
it's like
just to magnify the effect of this ripple.
Yeah, four kilometers long. So what you're doing is you're passing the light over a long distance so that when that space is stretched out a tiny little bit, then the effect is enough that you can see it. And again, it comes in altering those interference patterns. But they have two of these. They have one in Washington and one in Louisiana. Can you guess why they have two of them?
That's how you can triangulate where things are occurring. Whatever you're measuring, this ripple you're feeling, well, where is it in the sky?
Right.
Because, if it's two black holes, they don't exactly show up very well on a telescope, do they?
Right.
Yeah, this is like one of the only instruments we have that can detect stellar objects without using electromagnetic radiation, without using light of some sort.
And so what they're proposing to do here, they're wanting to shut down one of them. They haven't said which one. It's one of these examples of where we are pulling back on basic research. And you may say, why do I care whether we can detect two black holes that are colliding 1.3 billion light years away? Well, we don't know how our understanding of this phenomenon, how our understanding of these things is actually going to come into play later. Back in the 1920s, we're in, the 100 years ago, we had all of these discoveries in theoretical physics. Those discoveries are essential to you being able to hear me right now, to the whole sort of digital world that we live in. Without an understanding of quantum mechanics, none of that exists. So we invest in pure science. We don't know how it's going to bear fruit. I personally think that just understanding the world is a good thing. And this is kind of basic to being human, is to try to understand the world around us. But it also, we don't know what the benefits are going to be, what the practical benefits are going to be 50 years from now, 60 years from now, 70 years from now. We pull back on all of this investment in science. We are handicapping ourselves.
And wouldn't you want America to be at the forefront of all this research? That's prestige for our country.
Yeah,
Let's get it.
This is an America last science policy.
Basically, right? Yes.
I'm going to put a link to this article in the show notes. I'm also going to put a link. This is a really cool video I found with Brian Green. We'll put the link to that up as well. Up next, we have Yakety Science Ruins the Movies. In this segment, we will take on a Hollywood blockbuster and pedantically explain how they got the science so incredibly wrong. Yes, we are those know-it-all people that you never want to take to the movies. We just can't enjoy ourselves, and we want to share that lack of joy with you. Up this episode, we have the 10% problem. The movie we've chosen here is Lucy. Lucy is the brainchild of director Luc Besson, who's made much better movies than this one. It is the story of drug-induced godhood, or perhaps goddesshood. Scarlett Johansson plays the titular heroine. She is coerced by a truly awful boyfriend into delivering a suitcase full of a new drug, CPH4, to a gangster. Ultimately, a package of CPH4 that has been implanted inside her abdomen bursts open, and she gets this massive dose of CPH4, and her eyes go blue, and there's all sorts of blue electricity running through her bloodstream. And then this allows her to unlock 90% of her brain, because as we all know, we only use 10% of our brain. Morgan Freeman plays a scientist in this whose lecture frames the events that befall Lucy. So here is a little bit of Morgan Freeman's mind-withering lecture. Yeah, if you do use 10%, after you listen to his lecture,
you're probably down to 8.
Down to 8 or 7%. Here's Morgan Freeman.
100 billion neurons per human, of which only 15% are activated. There are more connections in the human body than there are stars in the galaxy. We possess a gigantic network of information to which we have almost no access.
Sir?
Yes.
And what would be the next stage?
Well, the next stage would probably be control of other people. But for that, we would need to access at least 40% of our brain's capacity. After control of ourselves and others, would come control of matter.
All right.
These are just arbitrary numbers and just arbitrary abilities.
It's pretty tough to take. So just to lay the facts out there, the idea that you would have 100 million neurons in your brain, you would spend all of the energy to build those neurons and to put them together, and then you would fail to activate 85 billion, did I say million? 85 billion neurons is just mind-bogglingly moronic. You use 100% of your brain. It doesn't make any sense on many, many levels. How would a complex structure like this evolve if it's not being used? It had to be used to be evaluated, to be seen by natural selection. So it would have to be used in order to evolve in the first place. If you built a big structure and you didn't use it, that's a big, huge waste of energy. So you would be outcompeted by all the guys who were making smaller brains and using all of it. On so many levels, it just doesn't make any sense. Now, you can learn things. Your brain changes. Every time you encounter a TCC professor, they teach you something new, and your brain changes, but it doesn't change by activating neurons that are sitting idle. You form new circuits. You form new connections between neurons. You form new circuits that rewires the brain. But that doesn't represent going from the use of 10% to the use of 20, 30, 40, 50.
I feel like this is a widespread and kind of pervasive misconception that people have. People love throwing around this so-called fact. Yeah. Where does it even come from? I feel like we've seen this in so many movies.
I don't know exactly where it comes from. I've heard some people trace it back to the writings of William James and the idea, maybe not the 10% number specifically, but the idea that we have sort of this untapped potential of the human mind. I think it's just something that we really want to believe. It's like the scientific corollary of all those fantasy adventure stories about discovering that you're a wizard or you're the king, right?
You suddenly have power you didn't know.
You're the heir to the throne. You certainly have power that you didn't know about. I think it's a fantasy that deeply appeals to us, but it's just the science here is just appallingly bad. And it appears in lots and lots of different movies. I pick Lucy because Lucy is the apotheosis of this fallacy. But you can see it in movies like Limitless with Bradley Cooper, where he again comes upon a drug that allows him to unlock his limitless potential by giving him access to the 90% of neurons that are sitting around doing nothing up in his brain. And even Flight of the Navigator, if you remember the 80s sci-fi
classic. I love that film. Yes, I do like it. I watched it recently.
Yeah. And how did they get all of that navigation ability into his brain?
Yeah, he was only using, X percent of his brain, So the ship used the rest of his brain as a hard drive to store all the maps.
Now, I have to say, there is a heck of a lot of science apart from this that in the movie Lucy that is also really, really bad. And so just like basic facts, like they keep repeating over and over again, life arrived on the planet a billion years ago. Maybe 2.7 billion years off, right? We know that life has been on the Earth for many, many billions of years. Certainly by 3.5 billion years, we have pretty clear evidence of life there. There's just so much. There's something in there where they talk about locking the infinite capacity of the cell's nucleus. What are they talking about? What is the infinite capacity of the cell's nucleus? There's so much in there. It's just one thing after another.
How does gaining more brain power give you telekinesis anyways?
Well, and that's the other thing here that's just so silly that it's like criticizing Flash Gordon or something. To criticize it. But it's not clear to me how using all of your neurons, I mean, even in principle, what is that? How is that supposed
to
happen?
How are you exerting this force?
By sending electrochemical signals around in your brain. How is that changing the force of gravity and causing people to stick to the ceiling, right?
This is the kind of thinking that I expect from someone with only 20% of his brain.
Right, that's right, yeah. So I just can't see it. That's the problem. I use too little of my brain. I just can't see the potential, the limitless potential.
Goodness.
All right. So truly horrible. It is hard to watch. I went to see it in the theater when it first came out, and it was hard to sit through it without lecturing the people around me. Can you believe this? Ridiculous. All right, next up we have our interview with the geologist, Claude Bowles. Thanks again for joining us, Claude. I want to start us off here by having you tell us a little bit about the geology in our area, the Tulsa region and Oklahoma more broadly.
Yeah, the geology of Oklahoma is primarily sedimentary rocks. Probably 90% of the rock in Oklahoma is sedimentary. The igneous rocks are found in the Wichita Mountains. Metamorphic rocks are not found here in Oklahoma. Apologize for that. But here in the Tulsa area, okay, the rocks are of Pennsylvanian age. Okay, in geology, we have a topic known as geological time, and we start with the age of the Earth at 4.6 billion years. And they're asking me, how do you know the Earth is 4.6 billion years? We get that age from age dating, uranium lead age dating meteorites.
I learned an interesting fact recently about the meteorites, which is that we find a heck of a lot of them in Antarctica.
Yes, there's two places that are great for finding meteorite: Antarctica. And why is that? Okay, what's the color of the landscape in Antarctica? White. And what's the color of meteorites? Black. And so, yeah, black shows up great against the white background. Okay, the other place that's there great to find is in the desert, particularly the Sahara Desert. And why is that? Because it's dry. Because the meteorites have a very high iron content. And you know what happens if you leave iron outdoors? It rusts and deteriorates. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so a meteorite lands here in Oklahoma. If we don't find it right away, it's going to deteriorate to rust.
Yeah.
Not good. And so the desert is a fantastic place. The challenge is that there's not many roads in the Sahara Desert. Who finds most of the meteorites in the Sahara Desert? The nomads. Mm. I know a meteorite collector out of Seattle who regularly travels to Morocco and then takes a camel out into the desert and meets with the nomads.
So to bring us back to Oklahoma, so we've got mostly sedimentary rocks around here. I think you were kind of creeping up, sort of telling us how old those rocks are. So what geological periods do the rocks in our area come from, the ones that are at the surface here?
Here in Oklahoma, they're Pennsylvanian age. Okay. The Pennsylvanian is around 300 million years ago. To the east of us, the rocks are older and they're Mississippian age. Mm-hmm. And to the west of us, the rocks are younger, Permian age. Okay. And so we have this stratigraphy, that's the layering of the rocks. Because one of the concepts in geology is layer cake geology. Mm-hmm. To put the layer on the top, you have to have the layer on the bottom. And so the layer on the bottom is the oldest, and mm-hmm. the layer on the top is the youngest. Right. And so as you go from east to west across the state, we go from Mississippian to Pennsylvanian to Permian. Mm-hmm. And the boundary line is about the area of Stroud. And in the eastern part of the state, we have mostly gray limestones, brown sandstones. As you get to the western part of the state, you have the sandstones are primarily red. So you got red to the west, gray and brown to the east.
Okay. So you've got rocks of different ages as we drive across the state of Oklahoma. So, but that's not vertical, that's horizontal. So is this because the strata are turned and morphed
tilted.
And, yeah, tilted,
yes, they're
right?
Tilted. Yeah. And the rocks in Oklahoma are tilted from east to west at about a 10-degree angle. Mm-hmm. And so it, they're originally laid down horizontally, but you had a slight tilt, and that tilt came from the collision of the formation of Pangaea. That is, Europe and Africa, South America, collided with North America, created the Appalachian Mountains and eventually Rocky Mountains, and Oklahoma got caught between the two of those like a vise, and the rocks tilted from east to west.
Okay, interesting. And so a lot of these sedimentary rocks are the kinds of rocks that you look for when you want to find fossils, right? Because
yes.
That's how fossils form. So where are the best places around here to find fossils, and what kind of fossils could you find?
Favorite fossil locality is a little town called Lotsey. You get on Highway 51 that goes from Sand Springs to Manfort. 7.5 miles along that highway, there's this little town called Lotsey. Just to the north of that, or the right, as you head west, is an outcrop of the Muncie Creek Shale and the Avant Limestone. In this Muncie Creek Shale, you find lots of fossils. You find coral, bryozoans, brachiopods, even trilobites. I got started in geology, grew up on a farming area. My grandfather had a farm, and one of my responsibilities was to pick rocks off the field. Well, when I started picking those rocks up, I noticed there were seashells, there were differences. My father bought me a rock mineral and fossil book. I was hooked, except that my grandfather gave me other chores to do because I never got many rocks picked, because that was a treat to go out there and pick those rocks. But one of the first fossils I found was a trilobite about 3 inches long, and I found it just over the ridge from my grandfather's farm. Yeah. Let's go back to Tulsa. Let me mention one unique rock formation here in the Tulsa area. It's called the Checkerboard Line. And those who traveled north and south on Highway 75 by Tulsa Hills, you may have noticed there is about a 3-foot rock ledge exposed. And when you're on 75, there's this kind of dip in the highway. Well, that's the checkerboard line because it's very resistant, and above it and below it is shale. And so whenever the engineers built the highway, they weren't so good at removing the checkerboard line, giving you that dip. Okay, now I'm going to take you to the Arkansas River, just to the west of the I-44 bridge. And that's where the checkerboard line crosses the Arkansas River. You can see it exposed whenever the river is low. And I've been told that's how you cross the Arkansas River with wagons before you built the bridge. Okay, the checkerboard line is called this because from the air it breaks up into 3-foot by 3-foot pieces. Mm-hmm. And so the checkerboard line is exposed. You have these V-shaped crevices. Right. The Arkansas River headwater is in Leadville, Colorado, which is a gold mining district. So yes, you can find gold in the Arkansas River, and I recommend to concentrate your efforts, go to the checkerboard line, scoop up some of that sediment, and sieve that.
Okay.
But I don't recommend quitting your day job.
would you find lots of fossils in that checkerboard line as well, too?
No, you do not, because it's so compacted. You find it, again, more in kind of shale because the rock is not so compacted.
Okay. So Lotsey is a good place to look for fossils.
Yes.
And you don't work for the Lotsey Tourism Bureau, do you? Because you have to acknowledge that if you do.
There's a lot to see. There's a lot to see at Lotsey.
Yeah, Lotsey's one of those little towns in Oklahoma. If you blink, you missed it.
Yeah.
Okay, there is a sign at the edge of Lotsey. It's about the size of a license plate.
Uh-huh. So are there other good sites around here that you would recommend for fossil hunting?
We can't expect him to give up all
hounds?
His secrets.
Well, thank you.
His
thank
secret
you.
Fossils.
He's a teacher. We don't believe in secrets. We believe in sharing knowledge.
Okay, the other place is around Skiatook Lake. And the other is Lake Bixoma. Okay, Lake Bixoma is the water source for, I think, the Bixby. You mm-hmm. have Leonard, and that's where. And I was just there with the Tulsa Geological Society. Mm-hmm. In fact,
yeah.
And a good point to make to our listeners that a lot of state parks, definitely your national parks, there was no collecting. Get permission before you get yourself into trouble. I had some students missed a couple of days of classes, and they said that they were out at a park, and they were collecting. Park ranger came and put them in jail.
Oh, my gosh.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I've never gotten my students arrested. How about you, Matt?
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
when chemistry students go to jail, it's math. But, that's man, right. This is a...
Yeah, so alert to your listeners is that get permission first, even on private property, is get permission.
Good advice. I want to mention these tours that you do downtown, and you talk a lot about the buildings downtown.
The number one building stone for downtown is the Bedford Limestone.
Okay.
And the Bedford Limestone is Mississippian in age, found in southern Indiana around the town of Bedford.
So what buildings downtown would be built out of that?
One building is right across the street from where we're recording. It's the TCC building, Metro Campus building.
Well, there you go.
It's made out of the Bedford Limestone, and that's where I start my field trip. And we stand and look south at the Boston Avenue Methodist Church. It's made out of the Bedford Limestone.
So the list here, Atlas Life Building, Beacon Building, Boston Avenue Methodist Church, Chamber of Commerce Building, Mural, Federal Building, First Baptist Church, First Christian Church. It's a long list of buildings.
Yeah, and there's also, add to that list is notable buildings that many of the listeners have visited, the Empire State Building, the Pentagon, and the Cathedral in Washington, D.C.
Very abundant. A popular rock.
It's a very popular rock because it's very abundant.
All right. So is there anything else you want to tell us about, Claude, before we wrap up? Anything fun and geological you want to share?
The state rock. We need to talk about the state rock, which is the Rose Rock, which is found south of Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And it's made out of barite, barium sulfate. Mm-hmm. And this is back to chemistry again, that Matt had not asked me, do I have a favorite element? Yes, I do. It's barium. It's barium because it's the composition of the barite. And, of course, the rose rock is attractive to look at. It's red in color. It looks like a rose. It's not a fossil. It's a mineral deposit. And it's also, I started out my career as a petroleum geologist. And whenever we drill an oil well, we weight the drilling fluid with barite, just in case if we hit a high-pressure zone, it's not going to blow out. Because if it blows out, it catches on fire, then you're going to call in Red Adair. And he doesn't start a job unless he gets $1 million check in hand first. So I'm partial to barium, barite. One more item. Okay, I'm also active in the Tulsa Rock and Mineral Society, and a plug for an upcoming activity is a rock show.
Excellent.
And geologists love rock shows, and whenever I use the term rock show, Saturday, July 12th, and Sunday, July the 13th.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Claude. It's been interesting.
Thank you.
Ironikos prosphilos eleluth.
Next up, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. Listen to the following. That's the sound there. It's the little rip, rip that we're listening to. Now, this is a tough one, so I'm going to give you a couple of hints here. Number one, this has something to do with a subject already discussed during this episode of Yakety Science. So think about the other things that we talked about today. And the other thing is that this is the sound of a couple of things running into each other. But what are those things? What's the context? If you think you know the answer, you can send it to yakityscience@gmail.com. Be sure to include your name and a good contact number, as well as your Social Security number, your date of birth, then your mother's maiden name, all of those things. Well, that's it for this episode of Yakety Science. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a scientist of note. This week's quote comes from our guest of this episode. Claude Bowles has volunteered his wisdom for the quote of the week. So take it away, Claude.
My quote is, all rocks have a story to tell, and it's my responsibility as a geologist to tell their story. Thank you.
Excellent. Thanks, Claude. With those wise words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
That was magical.
Thank you.
It's not magic, Matt. It's science.
Yakety Science.
Yakety Science.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakettyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you.